Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Tuesday, October the 14th. Today, the markets bounce back after the government announces it's buying out the banks.
There's not a bank in the world that has not been affected by the global storm, some more than others.
Talking about billions of pounds sounds a bit abstract. In Liverpool, where the credit crunch has been biting hard, what do they think of the government's buyout scheme there?
Well, my reaction is mainly going back to basics. You never spend what you haven't got.
And how baby lagerlouts are making pubs feel like nursery school.
No longer can one enjoy an adult evening without feeling one is dining in a creche. We now look for pubs where children are actively not welcome.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
Before we hear about any of that, let's hear today's news and have a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
The world's stock markets have responded with enthusiasm to government interventions in Europe and the USA. Every market has risen. After markets in Europe rose strongly, they soared in the USA. The Dow Jones in New York closed up 11%. That's the largest daily jump in 70 years. In Asia, dealers continued the rally strongly, with Japan's Nikkei index gaining 13%. The 15 members of the Eurozone unveiled their plans to buy into their banks after Britain led the way. This has also been followed by the Australian government. And in the United States, the Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, called in the heads of America's biggest banks to discuss how his government could also buy shares in troubled firms. We'll have more on the economy shortly in Guardian Daily. The House of Lords has overwhelmingly voted down the government's bill to allow police to hold suspected terrorists without charge for up to 42 days. As a result, the government's withdrawn the proposal. It was announced in a late-night statement by the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith. She said the counter-terrorism bill would now be put forward without the 42-day measure, but the government would keep a bill containing the plan in reserve in case of a terrorist emergency. Amnesty International say there are an average of 2 executions a week in Saudi Arabia, and poor foreign workers bear the brunt of the system. Many of the death sentences are carried out in secret, and the government does not keep published statistics. But Amnesty says there were 2 beheadings on Sunday, which meant that probably 74 people had been executed in the country this year. Amnesty said foreign workers were often condemned in secret trials held in a language they didn't understand, and their families were not told. Fightings continued on the Pakistan border with Afghanistan. The Pakistan government's trying to crack down on fighters in the so-called tribal areas who are suspected of crossing over to Afghanistan to help the Taliban. Over 50 people were said by the Pakistan military to have been killed yesterday. The day the markets breathed again, says The Guardian on its front page, while The Times says the markets are soaring. For a change, the economic story that once again dominates the papers is a good one. Markets cheer the European rescue, says the FT. But the Mail's now looking for scapegoats with its headline about greed that fuelled a crash. It says city bosses gave themselves a record £17 billion in bonuses this year. And The Independent splashes Sir Fred Goodwin, the head of RBS, who's resigned as the banker who wouldn't say sorry. He walked away with a £580,000 pension. The Sun and the Mirror do tell us that Brown saves the world and has started a war on fat cats, but they splash that servants nick Beckham's gear and flog it on eBay. Apparently, 2 housekeepers working for Posh and Becks in Hertfordshire have been arrested after the couple's possessions were found being offered for sale on the internet auction site. On the back pages, it's mostly about Steven Gerrard before this week's England football match against Belarus. Everybody says he's worried for his place in the team and that he fears the axe, as the Mail puts it. The Liverpool captain admits his form for his country doesn't match the performances he gives at his club, and he's worried he may lose out to Frank Lampard. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The government will not be a permanent investor. Over time, we intend to dispose of all these investments in an orderly way. In the meantime, our shares will be held at arm's length. Other banks have agreed that they will themselves inject additional capital, and as part of the plan, we are laying down conditions to ensure the taxpayer gets a fair deal. First, bringing an end to rewards for failure. The board of the banks which received injections of capital from the taxpayer will take no cash bonuses this year. It has also been announced that 4 senior board members will be leaving their positions. And going forwards, rewards will only be and firmly based on performance and long-term value creation.
So far, so good. a positive response from the markets to the government's announcement that it was effectively nationalising three of the UK's biggest banks. It was ploughing £37 billion into the Royal Bank of Scotland, Lloyds TSB and HBOS. Gordon Brown said Britain could emerge stronger from the crisis and the taxpayer will benefit from the rescue package. The Guardian's business editor is Deborah Hargreaves.
I think there is this growing realisation that last week we were standing right at the edge of financial collapse and we seem to have pulled back from the brink now. It's like a sigh of relief has gone round the world.
And we saw details of some other countries following the UK's plan. Germany announced a 500 billion euro plan for its banks.
Yes, there's been a pattern now of other countries following the UK, and across the Eurozone, countries are adopting similar plans with slightly different ways of doing it, but essentially it's the same. So we've seen Germany and France do that, Austria and Spain. And again, on Wednesday, there will be a meeting to extend that sort of pattern to the rest of Europe. Of course, on Sunday's meeting just included the Eurozone countries, but the rest of the EU countries will be included from Wednesday. And now we've also got the US talking about recapitalising its own banks, and again following Gordon Brown's model. So that is proving to be a pattern around the world.
The winner of the Nobel Prize for Economics was announced yesterday, Paul Krugman. Coincidentally, he was writing in the New York Times and praising Gordon Brown's plan. I mean, it does leave him looking pretty good, doesn't it, the Prime Minister?
It does. Brown is being hailed as a saviour of the world's financial system. And I think Paul Krugman was expressing some surprise that a small country like Britain could lead the way. But it does seem to have worked so far. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of questions that still remain over these plans and over the longer term for the banking industry and for the economy. But so far, we seem to have come through.
How will the nationalisation affect the UK's balance sheet?
Well, it will make public sector debt go up. And I mean, it could double. It depends how the Office of National Statistics treats some of these banks. It depends whether the ONS decides that the government has control over these banks or not. When Northern Rock was nationalised, it decided that the government was controlling Northern Rock. So all of that bank's assets came onto the public sector balance sheet. It's still not decided what will be the case for RBS and HBOS and may say, the government doesn't control it, so we won't include the debts. But nevertheless, I think it has big implications for the public finances.
Yesterday also saw the departure of some of the bank bosses. Vince Cable's called for a purge of irresponsible bankers. Will more heads roll?
Possibly. I mean, I think we've seen the highest profile casualties so far and probably not before time. I mean, the banks, bosses that were responsible for driving those banks into the ground, they've mostly gone. It could be that we see some more casualties along the way. And I think those banks will now be run in a much different way. Of course, the government will have a seat on the board of some of them and will impose a stricter set of principles on those banks and the way they do business.
And the Financial Services Authority has written to bank chief executives warning that it won't tolerate what it calls unacceptable pay packages. What does that mean, though?
Well, what the FSA is saying, it's written to 30 banks, and it's saying we're looking at your remuneration policy, and if we see it as encouraging excessive risk-taking, we will force you to increase the amount of capital you hold. So that means the bank has to hold more a cushion against bad times, and it means it will make lower profits. It's difficult to see how the FSA is going to have a huge effect on executive pay, because it's largely trying to do this through moral suasion rather than through any more legislative process. And the government has said, as part of this recapitalisation, the banks involved can only pay bonuses next year, not this year, and then they have to be in shares. Whether that lasts for a longer time, I don't know. And there does seem to be a certain feeling among bank bosses today that they aren't going to have to cut back for the longer term.
Deborah Hargreaves. Well, as the stock markets have been clawing back some of their value, there's also been a political recovery of sorts for Gordon Brown. But it remains to be seen whether voters will punish Labour as the UK heads into recession. It's usually the poorest members of society that are first affected by an economic slump and the hardest hit too. The Guardian's Martin Wainwright went to speak in Liverpool to see how the credit crunch is biting.
I'm in Speke, south of Liverpool, a ward, a local council ward, which has the highest, among the highest deprivation statistics in the country in terms of unemployment. And I've just come to find out what people around here are making of the banking crisis, whether it affects them personally, and what they think about so much taxpayers' money being spent on three banks.
Well, everything's going up and up and up, and then all these banks are losing money, and the stock market's down constantly now, isn't it?
Well, my reaction is mainly going back to basics. You never spend what you haven't got.
I've just stopped a couple coming through speak, and can I ask you how you feel about the latest news in this saga?
Well, it is bad news, isn't it? I mean, you know, people who've got a few bob saving, they don't know which way it's going, or, you know.
Do you think he was right to spend so much money on it?
Well, I think so, yeah. Well, otherwise, nobody knows what would have happened.
Quite a lot of people have talked to me about putting their money not in banks here in Speke, where actually there aren't any banks. The last one left Speke in 1998, but in the credit union. So I thought I'd go along to see the Riverside Credit Union, who've got new offices next to the big Morrison's Superstore up the road. And I'm with Colin Strickland, who's the manager. Colin, what's this all meant for you in the credit union? What's going on?
We found quite a few people are now looking at the possibility of getting the wages and the benefits paid directly into the credit union. They don't want to use the banks. They're not too sure about the banks. They're upset with the charges that people are getting and think they're going to get in the future. So it's been a positive effect for us.
And how does the credit union avoid being caught up in all this? How does the credit union fit into the general pattern? Are you completely insulated from the whole banking side of things?
Yes, we actually bank with the Cooperative Bank itself, but we're also part of the Financial Ombudsman Scheme, and we're also part of the FSA Compensation Scheme. Mm. So we are the same as others. Up to £50,000 worth of savings would be covered if anything did go wrong.
Do you have anybody of that level? Or that's a massive amount for a credit union saving, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge amount. We don't have anyone anywhere near that, no. I mean, what you mostly find is people saving £10, £15, £5 a week, and it builds up over a period of time, but we wouldn't have anyone who's up near £50,000 now.
That report from Martin Wainwright in Speak in Liverpool. And there's full coverage of the banking crisis today at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website, a lot of these negotiations to rescue the financial system have been carried out through the night. How do they do that, asks Patrick Barkham at guardian.co.uk/G2. Polly Toynbee says, tax the rich. She calls for a tax on the richest 1% in her column today. Tell her what you think at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And Steve Rose asks architects, can you design a beautiful power station? And if you can, would you? Or should you? Read about that, guardian.co.uk/arts. Philip Nitschke is nicknamed Dr. Death. His book on voluntary euthanasia is banned in his native Australia. Yesterday, he addressed an audience of over 50s in West London. He calmly told them how they might take their own lives. The Guardian's Stephen Morris was in attendance.
And there's a danger then that you might get halfway through it and go to sleep. And that's, of course, quite counterproductive. You want to get the whole volume, the 100 mils, consumed.
Hey, my name is Philip Nitschke and I'm the director of Exit International.
How's the morning and the afternoon gone for you today?
Oh, it's been a good gathering. It's our first in London, so we were always a bit apprehensive. We didn't sure what to expect, but it's a good group. Of course, the interests are pretty universal. Elderly folk, well elderly folk, who really want to know what their practical choices and options are, because I suppose many of them are well aware that the laws may not change, and so unless they take steps to prepare themselves in some practical way, they may get caught.
Oh, it's a very controversial area.
Well, it is, although I must say amongst the elderly people, they don't see the controversy and don't find it such a disturbing concept that many younger people seem to. They approach the issue with a much more of a pragmatic and matter-of-fact a manner, because they are facing their own deaths at a much closer time, and so they see the need to prepare. And many of them see, of course, the sense in preparing by making sure that they've got access to a practical strategy themselves, so that they don't get caught and then have to ask someone else to take steps to help them, because that's where you get into really difficult legal issues.
But legally, you have been sailing close to the wind, that there's been talk that this gathering may be illegal.
Yes, there's certainly that opinion has been expressed, and we've, of course, had our opinions, legal opinions, and there's obviously a grey area here. I don't particularly want to be part of a test case to find that out, but our argument is that the provision of information is, in fact, and it empowers people to make correct decisions, and that the converse, that is, keeping people in the dark, is actually not a process which can be defended. So we see the wisdom and hopefully the legality of making sure that people understand the issue well, understand the concepts that they're dealing with, understand the practicalities of suicide in a manner that allows them to make informed choices, as being consistent with good health and ultimately an ethical thing to do.
He used a computer hooked up to lethal chemicals to assist 4 people in Australia to take their lives. Assisted suicide for a short period was legal there.
And what do you make of what you've seen here today, Jean?
It's very interesting, and above all, I'm especially interested in the ability to have a choice at the end of your life. That's why I'm here.
Can I be very delicate and indelicate and ask how old you are?
I'm 75.
So are you actively thinking about what you're going to do in the future?
No, I'm not actively thinking about it. I just want to be prepared. And I want to have that option, because I think too often people say, oh, well, I'll think about that later, and then they find themselves in a position where they can't do anything about it because of perhaps a stroke or some kind of illness like that. So I want to know what the options are.
Some people are saying we're quite close to the legal limit of what's permissible here today.
Yeah, I think it probably is quite near the limit, yes. I just hope they don't shut him down.
Other people have said he's exploiting the elderly people, trying to get money out of them.
Well, he hasn't asked me for any money yet, so I have no reason to think that's so.
Can I just turn to your husband?
I'm 86.
And what do you feel about what you've seen and heard here today?
Well, it's very interesting, because at least it's given me some idea of what drugs or what avenue I might take if I decide to end my life. But I'm healthy at the moment, so it's irrelevant.
And I understand you've got 10 children. Do they know you're here today?
No, none of them do. I haven't told them because, I mean, I may tell them at some point later on, because I think it might distress them. Because I think if you're thinking of somebody else's suicide, you're more distressed about it than if you're planning your own.
Stephen Morris reporting. My name's John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, should children be banned from pubs? And we'll hear claims that in Cold War Czechoslovakia, the writer Milan Kundera reported a Western spy to the communist authorities.
His friends say, we know he's eccentric, we know this is strange, but we have said that we are not going to comment on Milan Kundera until after his death.
But first, Dominique González-Förster is the latest artist to fill the Turbine Hall in London's Tate Modern. It's one of the most prestigious and challenging commissions in the contemporary art world. Well, what has she done? She's reproduced other artworks on a bigger scale to make an apocalyptic vision of the future.
One of the ideas that came to my mind was to imagine a possible future for the Turbine Hall. I know it was an industrial space, and I found it interesting to think what it might become 50 years ahead. So this installation belongs to science fiction, which is not a common genre in visual arts. I mean, we have it in literature, we have it in cinema. We don't have it so much in visual arts because it's not so easy if it's there to make you believe it's the future. It's connected to the present, but it's also connected to London and Britain as the place where since science fiction started. So it's not just here and now, it's also War of the Worlds, it's also 1984, it's a whole set of fictions, and London as a city under fictional attack. But it's true that the context right now has an influence is not analyzing it, it's not but it's surely reflecting it, for sure. I hope it will be like a giant editing room where every viewer can somehow make a kind of make his own editing, something between a 3D movie connected to worlds, and have this possibility to go through all these references.
Dominique Gonzalez-Furster, and you can see a video of her discussing her work at Tate Modern today at guardian.co.uk/arts.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
The Czech writer Milan Kundera, whose novels include The Unbearable Lightness of Being and The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, has been accused of betraying a Western spy when living under communist rule back in 1950. Kundera's now 79 and he's lived in France since 1975. He rarely talks to the media. The Guardian's Kate Connolly takes up the tale.
Well, this is the reclusive star of Czech literature who has been living in France for years, and he has been accused by a Czech academic of denouncing a fellow countryman and a Western intelligence agent to Czechoslovakia's communist secret police. For this, the man was sentenced to over 2 decades in a hard labour camp. Initially, he was to be executed, but he ended up spending 14 years in a hard labour camp of a 22-year sentence. What we know from files that have come to light, police files going back to 1950, was that Milan Kundera walked into a police station on the 14th of March 1950 to tell the police that he had met a friend, Eva Militka, who was putting up a man called Miroslav Doracek, who had deserted from military service in Czechoslovakia. And he was spending the night in her flat, and that evening the police, based on this information, went to the flat and took him away. Then he spent the next 2 decades in prison.
As you say, Milan Kundera is reclusive. He never gives interviews to the media. Is he likely to respond to these allegations?
Well, he has so far refused to comment on the revelations. The man who has brought this to light, Adam Hradilek, who works for the Institute for the Study of Totalitarian Regimes in Prague, he has made repeated attempts to contact him and also his friends. His friends say, we know he's eccentric, we know this is strange, but we have said that we are not going to comment on Milan Kundera until after his death. So far we have had nothing from Kundera, nothing from his publisher, and commentators have just been picking at bits of interviews that he has given in the past, looking for clues. There was an interview he gave to the British writer Ian McEwan a few years ago in which he said, we constantly rewrite our own biographies and continually give matters new meanings, and said that really his private life was nobody's business. But this really does throw new light on Milan Kundera, who of course we know as the author of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and many other works that basically give us the picture of Czechoslovakia under communism.
How damaging is this to Milan Kundera's reputation?
Well, we know Milan Kundera to be this great of Czech literature, quite a reticent man, doesn't comment very much. But this looks to be very, very damaging if it is in fact true. If he's not going to comment on it, the question is whether we will ever actually get to the bottom of it. But we've got the man who was denounced and spent time in prison, who's now living in Sweden, and he has refused to comment. He still believes that the person who denounced him was not Kundera, but was the woman in whose flat he stayed. This man has since had a stroke and is now unable to really throw light on it. So the only person who can is Kundera himself. He's now 79. Maybe it's something that he will want to talk about at some point.
Kate Connolly. Pubs are being spoiled for some customers by the presence of children, according to the latest edition of The Good Pub Guide. The book's joint editor, Fiona Stapley, told me what her readers have been saying.
We've had all sorts of comments like, no longer can one enjoy an adult evening without feeling one is dining in a creche. I'm sick of going into a pub and feeling I'm at play school. We now look for pubs where children are actively not welcome. Far too many pubs are allowing children to run around playing near the bar. It's very sad. We've had lots of our readers saying, please, can we introduce a no children symbol and put it at the top of pubs entries where children are not allowed?
It all sounds a bit sour and miserable, doesn't it?
It does sound a bit sour or miserable, but I think really it's the sort of toddlers that are allowed to sort of run around unchecked while their parents are sitting having a drink or are halfway through a meal and chatting with friends, and they can't be bothered to keep getting up and going to grab their toddlers and put them sitting down again. They just think, oh well, you know, they won't go outside, they won't get run over, you know, it doesn't matter. But there are lots of people sitting in the pub who are thinking, oh goodness, I wish they'd leave.
I mean, other countries welcome children in their bars. Shouldn't the British be a bit more tolerant of children?
Well, again, I think there's a sort of middle ground point here. I mean, I think there's 90% of the pubs in our book say that they actively do welcome children. But I think they would rather that they weren't running around tripping up waitresses and banging into people and, you know, treading on dogs' tails and this kind of thing. So I think we've got to find a sort of a happy medium.
What might that mean in practice? Restricting the amount of time children are allowed in pubs?
A lot of pubs do stipulate quite clearly that they will only allow children, say, at lunchtime or only up until 6 or 8 p.m. and they're not allowed anywhere near the bar counter. And they must, you know, perhaps there are room restrictions that they're only allowed in the restaurant or the dining room, or maybe they're only allowed in the lounge. So I think pubs do try, a lot of pubs do try very hard to sort of make things easy for those who don't want children, but also for those who do want to come in with their families and have a nice family time.
But again, you don't see these sort of restrictions in European bars. You know, is this a peculiarly British problem?
I think it is a purely British problem, actually. A lot of continental places seem to have children who are quite happy to sit down and chat with their aunts and uncles and parents and not have this great desire to get up and run around screaming once they've had their food and they're bored.
One of your readers reports asking a father to keep his baby quiet. I mean, anyone who's had a baby knows that's easier said than done.
Yes, I know. No, I do agree. I'm sort of stuck in the middle here trying to sort of see both people's points of view. I mean, it's very hard for the landlords because they don't want to ban families, because obviously if a family are coming in with, you know, to have a meal, it's bringing in much needed revenue. But at the same time, they also want to keep, you know, the people who don't want children making a noise happy. So it's very, very difficult. It's a very fine line to cross. And you know, we do get an awful lot of letters from families saying that they're fed up in some pubs, obviously not all of them, but in some pubs they're made to feel sort of like lepers, and, you know, they go in with their family and they're treated with disdain and coldness, and it spoils their visit.
Fiona Stapley from The Good Pub Guide, and you can have your say on that or anything else that you've heard in today's show at guardian.co.uk/guardiandaily. Today's programme was produced by Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you very much for listening.